of a celebration. A celebration of life, death, and the struggles of our ancestors.
Arrested Development on Stay Human. My name is Michael Goldberg. I get to do this program every Sunday night dedicated to the proposition that we got to stand up and dance every day, that we got to speak up and find each other for spirit and for courage to stay human. On today's program, we'll be hearing from a few people who are in prison and from a few who have never served time. They've had the luxury to forget that everybody has committed a criminal act. At least that's what Emily Baxter says. She's the director of an organization called We Are All Criminals. We'll be hearing from her later in the program. First, here's a recording of a choir made up of women serving life sentences without possibility of parole, the Lady Lifers, they call themselves. All the members of the choir introduce themselves in this live performance of their song, This Is Not My Home. Thank you.
I'm a woman, I'm a grandmother, I'm a daughter, I have a son. I'm not an angel, I'm not the devil. I came to jail when I was so young. Home.
inmate number OB2472. I've been incarcerated for 27 years. My name is Thelma Nichols. I was born and raised in Philadelphia, PA. This is not my home.
OO8494. I've been incarcerated for 27 years. My name is Danielle Hadley. I was born and raised in Philadelphia, PA, and this is not my home.
Inmate 008309. I've been incarcerated for 27 years. My name is Teresa Battles. I'm from Newark, New Jersey, and this is not my home.
I am known as inmate 007080. I've been incarcerated for 30 years. My name is Deborah Brown. I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This is not my home.
OO5961. I've been incarcerated for 37 years. My name is Joanne Butler, and I was born and raised in Philadelphia. This is not my home.
Number 005634. I've been incarcerated for 39 and one half years. My name is Diane Hamill Metzger. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and this is not my home.
I am 004867, incarcerated 40 years. My name is Lena Brown, and I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and this is not my home.
My number is 005545. My name is Trina Garnett. I've been incarcerated for 37 years, since I was 14 years old. Born and raised in Chester, Pennsylvania, and this is not my home.
Can't take responsibility, then in God we trust is an exercise in futility.
justice for the men who should be free. My country tis to be, it's easier to defend, without distinction based on race, religion, or gender. Tis not befitting this or any other nation to put a fellow man through this humiliation.
Esperanza Spalding with her song, We Are America. I've been thinking this past week about the tens of millions of Americans on the receiving end of the criminal justice system. It's a group of organizations in town that got me thinking about this. The Art Gallery, the Human Rights Commission, the Parole Department, the college, they're all working together to sponsor a month-long series of events, films, talks about the way that justice and injustice get done in America today. The event is called We Are All Criminals. I asked Fred Friedman how we got to this point. I asked him because he's worked for justice throughout his career as a public defender, and I wanted to know, how can it be? What does it mean that one in four Americans has a criminal record?
Well, mass incarceration is an expression that first got it known in the 80s and the 90s. When the United States started paying the price for world-leading figures of people in prison. The original start of this concept came even earlier in the 1968 and 1972 presidential campaigns of then-President Nixon, who convinced the people that there was some kind of connection between anti-Vietnam demonstrations, Vietnam War demonstrations, and pro-civil rights demonstrations, and equated that to some kind of anarchistic movement, and then related that to marches and demonstrations somehow being un-American. That got tied into his Southern strategy, which meant we're going to turn the South from Democrat to Republican. And the way to do that is by racial division and convince folks that African-Americans needed to be locked up. And that's what happened. And when you combine that with the cocaine craziness of the 80s and the uptick of crime in the 70s and 80s led to the American politicians of all stripes supporting stronger sentences, longer sentences, and something called mandatory minimums, meaning you had to do at least all that, a certain percentage in federal court, 85% of your time, in state court, roughly two-thirds. So America started locking up numbers insanely high. We're far and away per capita. We lead the world in number of people that are locked up. And once they're out of locked up, they're on parole. They have a record. They can't get jobs, and all of which encourages recidivism. In other words, more crime. So this got combined, and then in the 1990s, both parties are responsible. President Clinton persuaded America that we needed to get even tougher on crime and lock up more folks. So we did that. And again, the numbers became insane. And when these people got out of jail, they couldn't get jobs. And this merged or coincidental with this was the beginning of the computer age, where everybody could look up everybody's past, find out too much about each other, and whether you had a very serious felony conviction or whether you had a conviction for shoplifting when you're 16, people could look it up, which discouraged more reemployment. Plus, made the bigots happy, because most states have laws that saying if you have a felony conviction, you cannot vote, which meant that it was a disenfranchisement of people who had committed crimes. Read, disenfranchisement, not being allowed to vote ever, of people of color. And that's how we got in this situation. So it discourages jobs, and it discourages employment, and it discourages families sticking together. And it means that in way too many families in America, if you want to see your dad or your husband or your wife, you take some crazy long trip to some state or federal prison somewhere in rural America. And that's the situation that we put ourselves in. We convinced ourselves that we could reduce crime by being tough on crime, which really meant being tough on black crime and brown crime, or in other words, what I'll call street crime. And somehow we convinced ourselves we were better off. Now, we couldn't afford it, and we still can't afford it, which is why you see people looking for sentencing reform. And that's the situation we're in, thus the expression mass incarceration. I should tell you that the state of Louisiana locks up more people than any country. It's over 50% of Louisiana are locked up or were locked up. It's truly disgraceful.
Thanks to Fred Friedman on Stay Human, broadcasting on Northern Community Radio.
Look around you, you're gonna see what I say. 'Cause as the world is getting smaller each passing day.
Passing day.
Now it's time to start making changes, and it's time for us all to realize that the truth is shining bright right before our eyes.
Before our eyes.
None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free. One of us is chained. None of us are free.
When I first heard about the project called We Are All Criminals, I thought, wow, that's a really counterintuitive title for something that needs community buy-in and participation. The idea is to transform the way we understand the term criminal. What does that word really mean? and it's a good idea for a project. I just thought calling us all criminals might not be the best way to attract an audience. I've never been charged with a crime. I don't think I know anybody who has. Although it's true that when I was a young man back in the 60s, a couple of the guys I hung out with routinely risked close encounters with the criminal justice system. We weren't best friends then and lost contact decades ago, but it's possible I do technically know someone who wound up with a criminal record. What I'm reflecting on here involves the use of low-level controlled substances. I was never a seller, only a customer, but it was illegal. It existed on a continuum of criminal activity. Back then, they could put you away for a long time for doing what we were doing, if you got busted. It's at this point in the reflection where I have to say to myself, we are all criminals. The continuum runs from smoking pot when it was still illegal to driving under the influence of smoking pot. How many times could I have been busted for that? All the way to larger criminal behavior people were never arrested for. Think of Nazi Germany, when Germans could tell themselves that the Holocaust was the work of monsters. They did not need to look themselves in the mirror too closely. Think of Vietnam. Not one soldier above the grade of lieutenant was ever convicted of, by definition, murderous war crimes, often against civilians. If you run the chain of accountability in that matter out to its logical extension, the whole country is implicated. We elected the politicians who made that war happen. Back to that big if. One of the reasons I've never been busted for anything is skin color. Traditionally, culturally, if you're not white, you are the other. This is changing, but the pace is glacial, and people with skin darker than mine are seriously, disproportionately represented among the quarter of this country's population who have criminal records. Coming to grips with that truth inevitably leads you to two of the largest crimes everybody got away with: slavery and the genocide committed against our native peoples. You can't even get your head around those two issues, much less make meaningful amends. They're too big, too old, too shameful. Now that you know I have a criminal past, would you be willing to take me on as a renter? Would you hire me? Okay, would you hire me if I were 30 years younger and had just finished doing time for possessing and smoking weed? I'm not saying you should. I'm just saying, let's talk. And that's what the project We Are All Criminals is about.
Thanks to Steve Downing for that. He's a frequent contributor to Northern Community Radio's arts coverage and to this program, Stay Human, which is heard Sunday nights at this hour. Northern Community Radio receives support for this and other programs from its listener members and from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Don't criticize it. Call it the weed.
fingers off the instrument too. Legalize it, yeah, yeah. That's the best thing you can do.
Legalize it. I'm told the criminal code is so broad and humans so much the way we are that everybody in America has at one time or another committed a prosecutable offense. We are all criminals. Emily Baxter, who founded the organization We Are All Criminals, will be giving public talks in September in Grand Rapids, Hibbing, and Duluth, along with related community events. I asked her how she got the idea to start this organization.
This was several years ago. I left public defense, and I actually used to be in your backyard. I was working for the Regional Native Public Defense Corporation, and we were officed out of Cass Lake, and I was living for some time in Grand Rapids, but had kind of moved around the North Woods. I left public defense for a number of reasons, but not the least of which was because I felt that the work that I was doing was just not enough. I wanted to work in broader policy change and be able to actually change the laws that were so profoundly affecting my clients. So I left the North Woods, moved down to the cities, and took a job at a legal nonprofit where our focus was on criminal records. And I worked in policy change and individual rights restoration law there. So in other words, helping people with expungements, with licensure issues. It was at one of our monthly expungement seminars where I met Anthony. He was the last participant to come into this workshop, and we held them in the basement of a government center, so a small, windowless, utterly depressing room. And He spent some time just pacing the back of the room before finally approaching the table at the front of the room where I sat. As he approached me, he pulled from his back pocket a copy of his criminal record, a printout he had received from a computer terminal two flights up. And this man was beyond distraught. He was tall, thin, black, and distressed. And you could feel the panic coming from him. So I was quite concerned about what the record might say. I thought that it must be something so egregious to warrant this concern. And so you may be able to imagine my surprise when I opened it to find that it contained no more than a theft, and a minor one at that. So I let out the short laugh of relief. I said, even if the court doesn't expunge the matter, it's not like your life is over. You're fine. And with that, he began to cry. And he told me that, in fact, earlier that day, he had considered taking his own life. That what was just a theft to me, to Anthony, was a lost job. It was missed housing payments. It was skipped meals. It was door after door slammed in his face. It was the loss of respect from his friends and family, the loss of a sense of self, the loss of hope. And around this time, I had, through that nonprofit, been driving all around the state of Minnesota, reaching out to legislators and landlords, employers and licensing boards, anybody that might have the capacity to create second chances for individuals with criminal records. And time and again, I would hear, you can't trust a con. Once a criminal, always a criminal. And those words came back to me as I sat in this basement room looking at a man with tears streaming down his face and holding a record that contained, again, just a theft. And I thought, what have I taken that wasn't mine? How many things have I stolen? What have I had the luxury to forget? And It was such a profound moment for me. And I know that sounds silly. It's not that I hadn't considered my own criminality before. I think that most of us have. But what I hadn't really thought about was the lifelong and profound effects of having been caught or having been accused, having that criminal record, how that would affect me throughout my life, in every aspect of my life. And so I started to question myself even more, not just what have I taken that wasn't mine, but what else have I done? And how is it that I have been able to get away with it? So I questioned to a greater degree than I had before my race and class privilege. I am a white woman. I am a middle-class white woman. And I started to question other people that are a lot like me. So people who have had the privilege to not be overly policed, people who have had the privilege to get away with it. And so now I travel the country asking those who have had the luxury to forget what they've gotten away with, and I collect these stories. And they were not hard to find. You know, one in four people in the United States has a criminal record, but I contend that four in four have a criminal history. And so when I interview people, we talk about the crimes that they got away with. So pediatricians who've blown up porta potties, police chiefs who in their youth burglarized liquor stores. We look at how their lives would have been different had they been caught through an examination of state statute, federal code, and broader social stigma. We look at the roles that privilege played in their ability to not be punished. And then importantly, I contrast these stories with stories of former clients of mine who were caught or accused and who suffer under that legacy of an interaction with the criminal justice system. And beyond former clients, I I share stories of colleagues and mentors and loved ones who have all gone through the criminal justice system as well.
That's Emily Baxter. We'll be hearing more from her in a moment. But first, here's one of the stories her organization has collected from someone who is now a college professor.
When I was in middle school, I was very bored in my suburban life that I had. And I just started shoplifting at the mall. And it was like really fun to try to like figure out different ways to shoplift. And then me and my friend would go home and then we would like pour all of the things out of our bags and just kind of take stock. And I was never, ever, ever afraid of getting caught ever because we just look like teenage shoppers. And the police were always looking after the people of color. And so, you know, I never had the fear of getting caught with that. And so shoplifting was kind of a trend in my life. I think I've known for a long time that I have certain privileges in my life. So I had a middle to upper class background and went to schools that reflected that. I am white. I pass as white. I'm, you know, female. And so I learned pretty early on that I could get away with certain things. And I did that. And I realized that a lot of the reason why I got away with a lot of my stuff is because of who I am and what I look like, and that the police treat me very differently. A lot of society treats me a lot differently than they would a black woman or a black man.
Just like I pictured it. Skyscraper and everything.
Hey, brother. Hey, come here, Slick. Huh? Hey, you look hip, man. Hey, you wanna make yourself $5, man?
Yeah, brother.
Hey, look here, run this down the street for me right quick, okay? Yeah, run this down the street for me.
Hey. What? Huh? I don't know. Give me your hands. What? I'm just going across the street.
Shut your mouth.
Oh, no. What'd I do?
Turn around, turn around. Put your hands behind your back. Let's go.
A jury of your peers having found you guilty. 10 years.
What?
Come on! Get in that cell, nigga.
God. No.
His hair is long. His feet are hard and thrifty.
I asked Emily Baxter what solutions her organization is going after. What's the agenda for We Are All Criminals?
The beautiful thing about the project, I think, is that it doesn't have a set agenda. There isn't a particular policy or practice or, importantly, politician that we at WAC believe is going to somehow dissolve the last 40-plus years of mass criminalization and mass incarceration. Instead, we exist to spark conversation. We exist to create tools for really questioning privilege and punishment and second chances. And we have been used by advocates around the country in support of their efforts that work best in their own backyards, in their jurisdiction. So, for example, there were advocates in New Orleans who were using WAC as a tool for conversation and talking about the inhumanity of solitary confinement. Seattle has used it in reaching out to employers about banning the box or removing the criminal records inquiry from job applications. New York advocates were using it to better articulate why education, both behind prison walls and once the individual is released, is so key to reducing recidivism and to validating humanity. And so it's been used across the country by varied advocates and activists and engaged individuals. Here in Minnesota, we have been a part of efforts to ban the box on employment applications and have worked on education equity concerns and I have worked to broaden expungement remedies so that people have a better shot at least a cleaner slate. There's no way you can actually completely erase a criminal history from all of the caches that exist all over the world, but you know, a better shot at a second chance. We've been a part of restoring the right to vote for individuals with felony records. We've lent our voice and our stories and the art and the passion behind We Are All Criminals to several causes, both here in Minnesota and beyond. I think that in looking at what justice is, it's important also to look at what it's not. From where I stand, true justice isn't overtly punitive or retributive, right? It's not punishment inflicted for punishment's sake. It's not blind vengeance that robs us all of our humanity. Justice is consequences, the consequences that are rational and reasonable and equitable and importantly, merciful. To me, justice looks like a mother being able to hug her son without him being strip searched before and after. A grandmother who is able to sit down with her daughter in prison without having to first cut off her wedding ring to pass through a metal detector. It looks like a 12-year-old black boy being able to play in a city park without being shot by police 2 seconds into their encounter, in the same way that a white boy should be able to play in a city park without being shot by police 2 seconds into their encounter. I think justice is at the core of our humanity. It's valuing, truly valuing one another. In a way that isn't just lip service, in a way that isn't meted out by the color of one's skin or the depth of one's pockets, but instead a true value of each person's life. This goes beyond background checks. This goes beyond policy. It goes beyond how we make choices of who we interview or hire or to whom we rent. This is about how we view others by how we view ourselves.
Thanks to Emily Baxter for her help with this program, and to Fred Friedman and Steve Downing, and to our house musicologist, Gail Otteson. My name is Michael Goldberg, thanking you for what you do every day to stay human. Here's Michael Franti with Spearhead.
Power, 9 to 5, and stars in the PM. And I love the sunrise, so I step out in the AM. The street is black and shiny from the nightly rain. The glory of the light brings evaporation. Mornings, fresh, oxygen, cleanest. I take a deep hit, help my mind stay the greenest. I'm already awake, so I'm not drinking coffee. Don't want a cigarette, cause it's a form of slavery. Walk into the store, cause I need a few items. The sun heats my blood, like a hit of vitamins. I need to buy some food for my dreads. I can't remember why, but I need a spool of thread. Well, a man with dirty dreads, he steps around the corner. He asks me for a dime, a nickel or a quarter. I don't have any change, so I'm stepping along. But as I'm walking past, he sings to me a song. There's a hole in the bucket. Picking up, cause I'm humming the song. The buses and the people
till I keep moving along. To the shopkeeper, I say, what's up? And I'm thinking about the man who's holding up the cup. I pay for all the stuff and get a pocket full of change. Well, should I give it to the man? It's a question in my brain. What's gonna happen if I give the man a dime? I don't wanna pay for another brother's wine. What's gonna happen if I give the man a quarter? Will he find a dealer and try to place an order? What's gonna happen if I give the man a nickel? Will he buy some food or some pork that's been pickled? I'm not responsible for the man's depression. How can I find compassion in the midst of a recession? How can all these questions come with my head? And I still can't remember why I need a spool of thread. There's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza. There's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza. Dear Liza. There's a hole. As I'm walking past, I'm trying to avoid him cause I know he's gonna ask me about the coinage that is in my pocket, but I don't know if I should put it in his bucket. I walk right past to think about it more. Back at the crib, I'm opening up the door. A pocket full of change, it don't mean a lot to me. My cup is half full, but his is empty. I put back on my cap and I start heading back. I reach into my pocket and I have a heart attack. Well, as I'm digging deep, I scream, oh no, there's nothing in the pocket but a great big hole. While I was busy thinking if he would buy a smack, the jingle in my pocket slipped through the cracks. No one has a change and it's not my head, but now I know the reason why I had to buy the thread. Cause there's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza. There's a hole.
What is music? Music is lyrics. Understanding and communication.